Heron for AM 1290.
Good afternoon and welcome to another edition of Money Talk. I'm Neil Kreisel, and Diane Duva and I are your hosts every week right here on AM 1290, repeated at 11, and on Saturdays at 6. We're brought to you by Cornerstone Home Lending, whose highly trained and experienced team takes great pride in helping people with home financing, offering competitive rates and a wide array of loan programs. Al Naldi's Cafe, one of Santa Barbara's oldest and most intimate restaurants since 1937, located on the corner of Olive and Cota Street in downtown Santa Barbara. At Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm in Santa Barbara, providing its clients with the personal care and attention of a small independent firm coupled with the vast resources of a major financial institution.
Hi, Neil. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. I'm very excited because we have a terrific guest today.
We do. We have Zohar Zev, an international businessman. We'll get into all the different things that he's done later on in the show. Thank you for being here, Zohar.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
And speaking of international, our first article today involves what is in the news for the last 3-4 days, actually for the last several months, is that Trump may have blinked with the China talks being put on hold and the tariffs.
Yucinich came out this weekend. I saw him on the TV saying there is no trade war. We're holding it off.
Well, but the first article that we have here is about the reality of even what Trump had asked for. He had asked for $200 billion worth of American goods be purchased by China, and the reality is they couldn't even if they wanted to. And in the article, it says economists say that purchases of China of $200 billion in American goods per year, an amount equivalent to more than half of the annual trade deficit with China, simply is not practical. The short answer is that these numbers are simply not realistic. Even if China stopped buying from other foreign products like Airbus and the European Union and soybeans from Brazil and purchased only American products, it would only add up to about $200 billion. And some economists think it wouldn't be greater than $50 billion. And if, in fact, they did buy all of our Boeing planes, it would just mean that Boeing wouldn't be selling them to other countries. So the whole notion that what we demanded could have possibly been achieved was ludicrous.
But isn't that really how – isn't that what the art of the deal really was about?
I'm happy because I think most economists are that – the deal fell through, his demands fell through. But the question is, how do you run foreign policy and international economics when the stock market has to go up, which it did today, because we failed at something? I mean, it's sort of everything sort of upside down, that the idea of a trade war was so would have such a negative impact on the world's economy, particularly our economy, that we had a hope that the administration's demands would fail. It's sort of nuts.
It's not where we like to be, is it?
No. The next article is talking about its headline, U.S. government bonds pay more than other developed nations. And there's a statistic that, which is the 10-year benchmark treasury note versus all of the other countries in the world. And right now, the spread is greater than it's been in years. That is, our rate is so much higher than other countries' rates. And that's because we have been much more aggressive in pushing up short-term rates than other countries who are not doing as well as we are.
Well, and if you think about it, Europe is about 4 years behind us in economic recovery, just based upon since 2008, the U.S. really led with stimulus programs, and we saw that happen, whereas Europe first tried austerity. And so they are still a few years behind us in terms of their road to recovery.
And one of the things this article points out is that the reason for this is that as the 2-year rate goes up, it's pushing the 10-year rate up, but the 30-year rate's not moving, because the 30-year rate is reflective of expectations about economic growth and inflation. And since that's more problematic, we're getting a flattening of the yield curve. And there is some concern in this article. They quote a number of economists that are afraid that the yield curve will turn inverted.
Well, and I think as that article points out, most of them think that in 2020 we'll have some sort of recession. You know, regardless of what's happening in the political arena, we can't have continued growth like we've enjoyed these last 5 years. That's not the way a normal market cycle works.
And one of the things that the article ends with that's sort of depressing is that because most of the money that companies have gotten from the tax reduction has gone to share buybacks rather than going to worker wage increases, is that this is not good for economic growth. And so the expectation that we are going to have, you know, a couple hundred basis points increase in GDP just is not realistic.
On that uplifting note, let's move on to the next article.
The next article is more depressing, and that is the mortgage rates hit 7-year high as ultra cheap era ends. And the first sentence of the article is that mortgage rates jumped to the highest level since 2011. And the problem is that as mortgage rates rise, it's less affordable to own a home. And the article says that a 1 percentage point in rates can lead to a reduction in home sales of 7 to 8%. And this has two implications. Number one, it makes purchases more difficult, but it also makes it difficult for people who own a home to move up. And so you end up with people who are, A, forced to stay where they are and not change housing, either whether the family needs have changed, but it also makes it less likely that you can switch communities and get a job that exists in another area than when you live in. So you're, in a sense, trapped by your lower rate. So you may be able to afford a $300,000 house in Cleveland, but you can't necessarily afford a $300,000 job in Austin that has a job that you want, because if rates go up, it becomes less affordable.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting because a lot of us, myself included, who, since we've become adults and entered into the workforce,
speak for yourself,
has only seen really low interest rates. But I think it's important to keep it in perspective that if you look back historically, we are still at, you know, to get 4.25 or 4.5 on your mortgage is still incredible, especially if you compare that to the 80s. What was your interest rate on the first house you bought, Neil?
8.5%.
Right. And yeah. So when you look at that, you say, we've just enjoyed a really low interest rate during our big purchases of homes.
Well, I have another theory, too, which is that increasing interest rates cause people to buy because they can't feel comfortable. They can wait. So for people on the edge who haven't bought a house, they may be convinced that they have to buy now or the train will leave the station. So maybe people should start calling Kelly at Cornerstone.
Yeah, to get their home loan.
Get on the train.
Exactly.
And so the next article is entitled, which I like the title, even if you don't like the article, The Robots Are Here, So Keep an Eye on Them.
Well, anyone who's a usual listener knows why you like this article.
Right.
Tell who the author is.
Jason Swig, who writes for the Saturday-Sunday Wall Street Journal. I'm a great fan of his. And he is writing to this weekend about one of the robo-investors. Now, one of the things about robo-investing that is attractive to people is the idea is you don't have to do anything. You don't have to think about anything. It's all done automatically by computer.
Oftentimes I hear it's because you don't even have to look at your statement.
Right. So check this out. He's outraged because Wealthfront, which is one of the largest robo-investors, has decided to move, without asking questions, money from their investors who were in their normal fund into as much as 20% of their assets in a very risky new fund.
So the way these work is you basically do a risk analysis online. You answer 5 questions. They say you're an X investor, and they put you in X investment, which is a bunch of ETFs, traditionally speaking, in the robo world. Now, what Wealthfront has actually done is they've said, okay, if you're X investor, whatever they've coined you, now you no longer have that list of exchange-traded funds. You have the exchange-traded funds, plus they've sold some of those and added in something like a hedge fund.
And what they've said is they define risk differently from other funds. They define risk not as the percentage of stocks versus bonds, but they said riskiness should be looked at in terms of leverage. So what they're doing in this fund is they're leveraging, meaning they're borrowing money, which causes you to have extreme movements both up and down. Well, here's the best part of the article. The article, the author went to them and said, you're doing this without people paying attention. And they said, well, no, in the prospectus, we say very clearly that you have to make sure that you are attentive and watching everything we do, which, as the author said, the whole point of robo-investing is not to have to pay attention at all. So the defense of this company, and by the way, the strategy so far, they're down 3% this year.
Well, and that's why I maintain, you know, robo-advising really isn't advice at all. Mm-hmm. What it is it's something that gives you a false sense of security that robots are better at something than people. But usually when you're making life decisions, in my experience, people want some feedback and they want to know what they're doing and what their options are, which, you know, I think perhaps a robo investment type platform works to a certain point. But when you start making big decisions like what house to purchase, when you're talking about a large sum of money, whatever that means to you, you normally want a person to help you with that.
So is that your way of saying that at Arlington you're not going to hire any robots?
Correct.
You're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back.
For prospective homebuyers, one of the most important steps of the loan process is getting clear and honest information from someone who will speak plainly and truthfully about loan programs and options.
I'm Kelly Marsh, Vice President, California, of Cornerstone Home Lending, where our highly skilled and experienced team takes great pride in helping clients obtain home financing with honest, knowledgeable, fast, friendly, and efficient service. As a Santa Barbara native who has spent the past 20 years in the mortgage industry and has closed over 4,000 loans, I'd appreciate the opportunity to earn your business and invite you to visit thekellymarshteam.com or call my office at 805-563-1100 to learn more about how Cornerstone Home Lending can help you determine the best way to manage mortgage debt to achieve a more stable financial future.
Licensed by the Department of Business Oversight under the California Residential Mortgage Lending Act. California Residential Mortgage Lending Act license number 41DB072220. California Financial Lending Law license number 60DB072528. Loan originator NMLS number 245822. Not a commitment to loan. Equal housing opportunity.
Hey, at our startup, my team and I move at the speed of tech 24/7, and every single day it's information overload. It's coming at me from all directions. And you know what? Bottom line, I just need the news that matters. So where do I turn? Local radio and TV. I want to hear from people who live and work in my town. They give me the real story with information I know I can rely on. So where else can I find out what's happening in my community? Weather and traffic, things that affect my family and my business. I want to stay informed by sources I trust, my local radio and TV stations, for the best entertainment, sports, news, traffic, and weather with no agenda and more reliable than other platforms. So if you ask me for the information I want anytime, anywhere, I stay local. Support your local station. Text radio to 52886 today. Furnished by the NAB and this station. Message and data rates may apply. Reply stop to opt out.
Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Cornerstone Home Lending. Since 1988, a mortgage banker and direct lender that believes in providing in-depth loan consulting to its customers in a personalized and honest manner. And we can be reached at 564-1290.
Or you could email us at moneytalk1290@gmail.com. And we are in studio right now with Zohar Zev, international businessman. And it's funny, before we went on the air, he talked about the unplanned journey, which is what he's entitled, we think, his biography should be. But tell us, how did you get to America? Tell us your early life story, because it's very interesting.
Now, do you want the real story or the makeup story?
Whichever you want to share today.
Well, I was born and raised in Israel. And as I mentioned to you guys earlier, my parents came from Yemen, and my dad came in the 20s, my mom in the 30s. They were young kids. Basically, both of them were orphans. My mom, there were 8 kids, only 3 survived.
Wow.
Till today, Yemen is very poor, and you can imagine, almost 90 years ago. So I was born and raised in the Yemenite quarter, which was basically at that time was kind of the slums of Tel Aviv. And I mentioned in my story that I owe my life to 2 women. Mm-hmm. One is my mom and one is my wife. And my mom had the foresight.
And that's why you're sitting here today with your success, for sure.
Well, yeah, because my wife is here and I followed her here. That's kind of the short version of the story. But my mom wanted to expose us, the kids, to better life and better schooling. And she moved us to what we call there, call it the white neighborhood, or Ashkenazi Jews, you know, European Jews, where even though it wasn't wealthy, but the education was important and so forth. And we moved there when I was 5, and I saw what the other people had, and I said, that's what I want to have in life. So I grew up there, done well in school, and then in Israel, the army is compulsory. So I went to the Israeli army, and I went to into a fighting unit like an Israeli Marine and so forth. And I happened to be in the Yom Kippur War in 73. And after that, I knew I wanted to go to university. I knew I needed to make my own money because where we grew up, we didn't have the funds to pay for that. I was the first generation in my family that had the aspiration and was going to college.
And well, I think in your story, what I found to be most striking is that when you were growing up, you went to a technical high school because you weren't planning on going to college, right?
Right. That was kind of, so when you talk about the unplanned, so if you go all the way to the beginning, we were supposed to live in the quarters and to stay there and to be like the rest of the people. And my mom moved us away from that. And then when I went to high school, my mom said, you're not just going to go to regular high school, because the plan was not to go to college. So at least when you go to high school, have a profession. So I studied electronics.
And I think, in reading it, that really set you up in the military to be able to have skills and have those skills translate into promotions and get more choices for you.
It is, but I was stupid and naive. So I was sent to...
Aren't we all at that age?
That, exactly. Well, show you what an 18-year-old, or I was 19 at that time, thinking about. They sent me to the Air Force to work on radars because I had the background. But I wanted to fight. I wanted to be in a fighting unit like my buddies. So I failed the training. And
oh,
I was
gosh.
Court-martial. And, yep, so I can go to be in a fighting unit. And so, yeah, even though I had the training, but the plan to work on radars, to be an engineer, and I realized in a very young age that I'm not the engineer type, with all due respect, And I didn't know what I wanted to do, but I wanted to do something different. So after finished the army, and I wanted to see the world and to save some money, and that was just after when terrorism started. The way that we know terrorism today, it started in 1972 with the Munich Olympic. Until then, you're too young, Diane, but Neil, you remember, you go in the airplane, you go all the way to the gate. There was no security, there was nothing. And all the American embassies, all other embassies, start to have security forces and to protect themselves. So I was one of the first one that joined the Israeli Foreign Service as a security, head of security.
Okay.
And we went through a training, and you have to apply, you got accepted, 4 months training, there were 10 of us. They ask after the end of the training, where do you want to go? They try to match you. And, of course, everybody wants to go New York, Paris, London, all the choice places. I was always adventurous, and I said, I want to go to a place I'll never go on my own. And they said, okay, Kathmandu, Nepal. I didn't know where Kathmandu was. I said, done. I'm going. So I went to Kathmandu in 1974. You have to understand, there were 12 million people in Kathmandu at that time, in Nepal. There were only 3,000 cars. There were no telephone lines. There was nothing. It was so undeveloped, pristine. And the best thing happened to me in Kathmandu, I met my wife, who is from California. She was there. My story, she was looking for her husband, and I wanted a green card. There was a match made in heaven. But she was a pre-med student, and she was doing volunteer work and visiting a friend, and she ended up being there 7 months, and I was there for a year. She came back, and I wanted to join her in Los Angeles, so I asked the Foreign Service to be transferred to Los Angeles, and they said, you have to wait for a year. I said, perfect. I bought a backpack, and I backpacked all over Asia for a year on $3 a day,
wow.
Which was one of the highlights of my life.
And was that the first time you had been to Asia?
Yes, when I left, yeah. I've been to Europe. I was sent when I was 17 to represent our high school to Europe on a summer camp. But that was the first time in Asia, and it was fascinating. So I came here in 76, and when I say I came here with a backpack, I actually came here with a backpack. But I was lucky enough because I had a job when I came here. I was working at the Israeli consulate as security, and I started going to school. So I'm a product of the great schools that we have in California. I went to Santa Monica City College. Then I went to Cal State Northridge. So I was working, 40 hours and taking 18 units a semester. I graduated in 3 years. And by the time, I didn't go to college until I was 24. So I had the maturity and the life experience. And by then, I wanted to go. And I knew that for me to compete in this country. I needed all the credential that I can get. So I went straight to graduate school. And I went, we talked about Thunderbird, which is an international business school in Phoenix. And with the idea still that I'll start international business and maybe go back to Israel or be dealing with that. Because
now, were you married to your wife yet?
But yeah, we were married and we were discussing that, you know. But the thought was always...
You were in negotiation then.
Well, you know, I wanted to have the options, you know, right. Because really my plan, I never planned to be in this country. I never planned to be married to someone like my wife and to achieve what I've achieved. So I finished you know, graduate school, and I was hired. At that time, there were a management training program by Getty Oil Company. And it was funny. I wanted to go to banking because all the international banks were really at that time, you know, expanding and so forth. Somehow they saw that I'm not the banker type for some reason. So I went to Getty Oil. And I got a great training over there. But I spent 4 years over there, and I realized that this is really – I started in their management training program, moved to internal audit, realized that I don't want to stay. The oil industry is really not my cup of tea. I mean, I travel a lot, but it's very specialized. So I met, and that's where I've learned the power of networking. I met a person in a conference, and we kind of hit it off. And just when I was looking for a job, Getty Oil merged with Texaco. Texaco took over, and they even though they gave me a job, I didn't want to stay. That guy from the other company called me and said, "I got an opportunity for you." And I said, "Okay, where is it?" And said, "Long Beach." And I was living at that time in Malibu. And I said, "Oh, commuting from Malibu to Long Beach." I kind of put a boundary. I said, "I'm not traveling more than 25 miles."
Well, you have to, because 25 miles could take you 3 hours in L.A.
Yeah, and it was 34 miles. I decided I'd go and have the interview. I went there. Was the best decision I made in my life because—
Excuse me, your wife was the best decision. Let's not get—
She was the second. The best business decision.
Right, exactly.
That I made.
I want you to be able to go home tonight.
Thank you, Neil. I appreciate that. I hope you are. I hope people can edit that portion. So I went there and I joined as an analyst. 6 months later, that guy was promoted to a controller, and they were going to bring another manager. And I just kept on doing my job. And after 5 months, the CFO at that time came to say, "You're doing a great job. I'm promoting you to the manager of the department. And by the way, we want to buy the company. We're a subsidiary of a public company, about $250 million. He said, "You know, you have an MBA, right? Can you put the deal together?" So I didn't know anything about it. I said, "Sure, I'll try." And I went, you know, there were no books. It was one of the first LBOs. So I went, I'll never forget, I went to the UC library and I was reading articles and making copies. It was, you know, putting money in the machines. Yeah. And we hooked up with one of the premier LBO firms from Wall Street, Clayton Dubilier. We did one of the first deals, and we were lucky enough to go private. And when we went private, my boss came to me and said, "Okay, good news, bad news. Good news, we were successful. Bad news, we don't need your position, but we need a treasurer. Do you want to be the treasurer?" He gave me the opportunity in my life that me today, knowing what I didn't know, I don't know if I would have given it to myself. I've never worked in banking. I didn't know anything. And he gave me that opportunity, and that set me up to be an executive. I mean, think about like 5 years after graduate school. I was a treasurer of a $250 million company. We had operation in 24 countries, 60% international. So I had to, and I went to all the banks and said, "I don't know anything about banking, help me." And being open and you find out that people really, you know, wants to, you know, they want to help. And it's kind of sink or swim.
You're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Diane Duva with an invitation for you to enjoy a great dining experience at my favorite restaurant, the world-famous Arnaldi's Cafe, one of Santa Barbara's oldest and most intimate restaurants since 1940. It's located on the corner of Olive and Coda Streets in downtown Santa Barbara. Arnaldi's specializes in traditional home-style Italian food prepared with the freshest produce, finest quality meats and fish, and the very best imported Italian meats, cheeses, and olive oil, along with local fish and specials from our Santa Barbara Farmers Market, and an extensive wine list served in the unique atmosphere of a candlelit dining room. Arnaldi's also caters to weddings and rehearsal dinners, receptions, graduations, birthdays, holiday parties, or any special event, with two large dining rooms, a huge heated patio, fire pit, two bocce ball courts, and a stone barbecue with red oak wood. And Arnaldi's is happy to work with you to create a custom menu and handle any special requests. Visit arnaldis.com or call 805-962-5394. It's a fact. Successful wealth management is built on strategies that focus on the big picture, take a long-term view, and establish deep and valued relationships. Hello, I'm Diane Duva, founding partner at Arlington Financial Advisors, Santa Barbara's trusted family guide, empowering you to make more informed and confident decisions. At Arlington Financial Advisors, we bring order and balance to your financial life by monitoring and managing risk so you can focus on your work, family, and enjoying the moment. We are a fully independent firm offering strategic financial planning, estate and tax planning, and private money management. Our plans and portfolios are handcrafted using a rigorous and disciplined approach, supported by a consistent yet highly personalized client experience. Our clients look to Arlington Financial Advisors as a home away from home, a comfortable place to protect what they've accomplished while they prepare for what comes next. Please visit arlingtonfinancialadvisors.com or call me, Diane Duva, at 805-699-7300.
Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm founded on providing thoughtful, objective, and comprehensive financial guidance for families and entities who are seeking long-term financial confidence.
And if you're just joining us, we have the honor of having Zohar Zev, international businessman, telling us his story, which is amazing, from Tel Aviv to Nepal to L.A. And then let's talk a little bit about what brought you to Santa Barbara.
Well, my mother-in-law brought me to Santa Barbara. So my mother seriously moved here about 31 years ago. And as I mentioned earlier, you know, when I work for the company that I work, I became the treasurer. I was there for about 12 years. I was groomed to be the CFO. The last year while I was there, a new CEO came. He brought his own CFO. And not only that, we also merged with another pump company and became a billion-dollar company, and they moved to Dallas. We didn't want to move to Dallas. So I moved and I became a CFO of a small medical supply company. So while the first 17 years of my career was in two companies, the next eight I was in five companies. Basically every year and a half I switched a job. Although I was in medical supply, video conferencing, marketing company, and souvenir companies. But the last company before Deckers, which I joined in 2006, it was a marketing service company. We did all the toys for Burger King. Hmm. So that's when I started working with China. We were buying everything there. The CEO who hired me, he was the co-founder of the company. He had a battle with the board, and he left the company. A new CEO came 2 weeks before Christmas, not knowing me or anything. He came to me an hour after he started and said, "I'm shaking the organization as high as I can, and I'm eliminating your position. Here's a $250 million public."
Eliminating the CFO?
The CFO, yeah. Which
did he wish you Merry Christmas also?
No, but he said Happy Hanukkah.
Oh, good.
So, yeah, it was very sensitive. clearly, it was predetermined because you don't do it without the board, you know,
right.
Work and so forth. And, you know, that's fine. I mean, CFOs, I mean, the longevity today, I mean, with deals and things like that, it happens quite often. And 2 months later, I had two job offers. And one of them was Deckers. At that time, Angel Martinez, and that many of you know, that joined the company a year before that. Angel was a third employee of Reebok, a very successful businessman and footwear industry veteran. And he was looking for a new CFO and someone that can take some other parts of the organization. And I had that job offer and another opportunity in Los Angeles. It's called a classic rental. They're in town too.
Right. Uh huh.
And they were doing what they call roll-ups. They were buying, you know, companies in different cities and put them under one umbrella. And by then, I've done over 20 M&A deals. So it was part of my expertise and my toolkit that I knew. And I was looking at those two opportunities, and both of them were equal. I mean, on the surface. And being a financial analyst by training, you know, I had a spreadsheet. I still have it today. And it's thought all the way, you know, salary, equity, but other unquantifiable items like quality of life and product and people and so forth. And I was trying to do weighted average and doing the whole thing. And my wife looked and said, why are you wasting your time? You know what you want.
Your geographical boundary was 25 miles? That's like
no, we removed the kids were out of the house. I was kidding about my mother-in-law lives in Santa Barbara. And when my wife called and said, hey, Mom, Zara has an opportunity in Santa Barbara. And it's shoes. And she said, shoes in Santa Barbara? He's got to take the position, you know? So, and we've been living in Malibu for a long time. We knew, we all had Uggs. We knew, you know, whatever. We knew the product. And I saw the brands and the lifestyle and Angel and what the company had to offer. And I wanted to join the company.
And for all of you listening, you can't see this, but he has Teva shoes on as we speak.
I don't have any other pair of shoes, which is non-Deckers shoes, so, you know.
Yeah, but he gets a discount. So,
I don't think I bought one pair since I retired almost 3.5 years ago. I still have one because I always wear flip-flops, so I don't wear them out. Anyhow, and it was an amazing ride. I joined the company. We were $250 million in revenues, about 200 employees. And almost 9 years later when I retired, we were $1.8 billion with about 4,000 employees. We expanded significantly. We had no stores, for example, when I joined the company. There was one store. And when I left, there were over 150 stores. Only 10% of the business was internationally, i.e. outside the United States, and all doing through distributors. They were not our own people, you know, those people we had the license to do in our business over there. And when I left, about a third of the business was internationally, and most of it was company owned. So we, like when I started, the company had only two people in Europe. When I left, there were 500.
Wow.
So building all this infrastructure, you know, hiring the people, creating, you know, the offices, all that stuff, dealing, buying all the distributor back, I was doing those deals. We also took over Japan. We opened, in China, we didn't have any presence. So we went into a joint venture, and I was the chairperson of the joint venture, and we expanded over there. So it was a lot of fun, a lot of hard work, but and the people were just amazing.
So now you and Angel, did you know each other before you joined? Because you have very similar stories where you both have come from, you know, not a lot of means and, you know, various. He's from Cuba, I believe.
He's from Cuba.
The two of you came together. How was your working relationship? Could you tell that you had similar shared values?
Yeah, you can see. I mean, the shared values because we both came.
Be careful. Yeah. He listens to the show.
I'm being very careful. Yeah. My lawyer is watching and listening to this. We did have a lot of the same values and the same experiences. As you said, he came from Cuba with his guardian, with nothing. He's also benefited from education. Mm-hmm. He went to UC Davis, and I think that we all believe in that. We live in a family culture. I know he's a very strong family person, myself the same. So, if you met him, our personalities are different. But we it was the yin and yang. We worked very well together from that perspective. And a year and a half after I joined the company, I became the CEO of the company and helped. You know, I was running kind of the back office of the organization while his responsibility unhails, you know, product marketing, vision and strategy and branding.
And so you talked a little bit about your experience in Asia through Deckers. And how did that help you, you know, parlay that into what you're doing now in China?
Well, so you asked what I'm doing. So what I'm doing in China right now, that's another part of the unplanned journey. As a matter of fact, it started before Deckers, just when I was in transition. Our son, who, by the way, lives in Santa Barbara and work in Boca here, when he finished college, he wanted an international experience. And I said, the future is China, go to China. And he had an opportunity, and he was working in China for a year and a half in Beijing, learned Mandarin. And he met a person who got the rights for subway restaurants in Shanghai. That person did not have experience in raising money, establishing companies. And our son, Nathan, said, hey, why don't you talk to my dad? He's got experience in that. So I talked to the person and said, look, I see the opportunities here. I'll try to help you form the company. And I met two companies prior to Deckers. One of our board members we hit it off, and he worked in China in the past, and he also had, you know, greater means than I did. And I was talking to him during while I was going through my job search, and I said, "Hey, Frank, by the way, are you still interested in opportunities in China?" I said, "Yes." So I brought up that opportunity, and that was exactly 12 years ago. And we gave them the seed money, and we started Subway. We built about 30 Subway restaurants. Mm-hmm. We raised money, of course, and, you know, built a company. Domino Pizza, 7 years ago, they were not doing great in China, and they saw the great business that we built, and they came to us and gave us the rights for Shanghai and Beijing. So we sold Subway, and we started concentrating on Domino, and now we have 135 Domino Pizza restaurants in Shanghai and Beijing, and we just got the rights for the rest of China.
Wow.
You're listening. We're going to be, this is very exciting because he, I don't know if you're aware of this, but during the break, he brought pizzas in for us. Now, they came a long way. It may be cold, but we're going to have a quick 2-minute pizza. You're listening to Money Talk on the Santa Barbara News Press radio station. We'll be right back.
You're not wired to have a response to this sound. You're neutral to it, and you can hear it repeatedly without feeling anything. But when we introduce a new stimulus, save the food, we've achieved pulling a natural or inborn response from you. Save the food. Why are we doing this, you may ask? Save the food. Because this ad is trying to change the world's behavior through brainwashing. Because 40% of all food in the US never gets eaten. Save the food. And that costs a family of four $1,500 a year. Save the food. Cha-ching. It's worsening climate change through the release of methane gas. Save the food. Cha-ching. And it's wasting precious natural resources like our fresh water. Save the food. Cha-ching. So when you hear this sound, don't be neutral. Rethink your behavior. Cook it, store it, share it. Just don't waste it. For tips and recipes, visit SaveTheFood.com. Brought to you by NRDC and the Ad Council.
People's Self-Help Housing is a national award-winning nonprofit organization celebrating 35 years of experience in creating affordable housing and self-sufficiency programs for lower-income families, seniors, and those with special needs. People's Self-Help Housing has helped to create over 1,000 self-help ownership homes and over 1,200 affordable rentals. 400 children annually are served through their K-12 education enhancement programs. People's Self-Help Housing is committed to expanding its core vision of providing housing for low-income families, seniors, and the physically challenged. The organization also provides complimentary social services designed to assist each resident. People's Self-Help Housing believes that affordable, safe, and quality housing leads to healthy communities, which benefit us all. You can help in these efforts to create more housing and related social services by calling 962-5152. That's 962-5152.
Talk brought to you by Arnaldi's Cafe, one of Santa Barbara's oldest and most intimate restaurants since 1937, located on the corner of Olive and Coda Street in downtown Santa Barbara.
So we were talking about Domino's Pizza in China, and so I asked at the break, you know, is it the same recipe as here? And so share for because it's just interesting. It's a fun little side fact.
Well, the basic recipe is the same, and clearly there are things that we have here that are over there, but they localize the menu as well. So there are things that, you know, we don't have here. For example, some of the pizza are sweeter. And also, even within China, you localize the various regions because some region likes more sweeter foods, and some of them like spicier food. The same true around the world. It's like if you go to McDonald's in Germany, you can buy beer, you know, at McDonald's over there. So it works the same order. Otherwise, you won't be successful.
So now, in terms of what's going on in the news with trade wars with China that we talked about at the beginning, how, if at all, will this affect your business?
The Domino Pizza?
The Domino Pizza.
The Domino Pizza, it would not affect it because it's all localized business. So on the contrary, it would help because if we are buying, let's say, cheese from overseas or so forth, it will help the trade deficit with the United States. So that does not impacting us. What's impacting us, and that's part of the thing that we are seeing here, and it will impact our trade, is the labor shortage in China. And I know nobody thinks that there'll be a labor shortage.
No one thinks that because everyone thinks there are just so many people.
1.3 billion people, but that's not true. We saw it when I was at before I left Deckers, and you see it more and more today. 20, 30 years ago, you had all this big labor pool. But because of the one-child policy, number one, that labor pool was shrinking, and also it's fascinating the progress and the desire that they have there to prosper and to be educated. I read when a couple of years ago when I was there. I go there every couple of months, and I read a study, and 90% of the parents wanted the kids to finish college. And 50% want the kids to have PhDs. Now, 50% are not going to be PhDs, but just the aspirations that they have.
That's a lot of time in school.
And everybody wants to have white collar. So you don't have any longer, you know, the blue collar jobs. And that's why you see factories moving out of, for example, footwear factories are moving out of China to Vietnam, you know, to Bangladesh. The new frontier now is Burma, for example.
Hmm. Yeah. So if there's some pressure that actually works, and the yuan gets goes higher, which is one of the things that America wants. That actually would help you buy. I guess your sales are in yuan. You'd be able to then buy supplies from outside at a better price.
Yes, if that's the case. But most of our cost is in the renminbi, in the local currency. Mm. You know, I mean, it's labor, rent. Mm. What it would help, because even if you think about food product, you don't buy much from the outside. Mm-hmm. Machinery, maybe you buy some ovens or things like that. But that's not going to help that much.
So you mentioned about the aspirations of the Chinese parents for their children. And I just want to go back to something you said earlier about your experience at a CSU school, which you have pointed out as one of the things that has really helped you succeed. And one of the things about you that I think we all ought to recognize is that you have decided to give back, and you're very active at CSU Channel Islands because of your experience at a CSU school, and you know, are helping the next generation or two or three generations later of kids that, you know, are having the same issues about not having the economic support. And, you know, I think that, you know, that just is a sign of how, you know, socially aware that you are, that you're not just sitting on your laurels as a successful business person, but you are really looking to help the next generation succeed.
Well, thanks for saying it. And you know, when I retired 3.5 years ago, and if you ask my wife, she said I got an F in retirement because I'm busy all the time. But I'm busy on my own timeline and with the people that I care for. And when I looked about I'm a type A personality. I cannot sit still. You know, like I tell my wife, I'll rest in the grave, you know. But I want to do what I want to do with whom I want to do when I wanted to do it. So I kind of divided my life into three buckets right now. You know, the family, nonprofit, and for-profit. We're lucky that we have two kids are in town. We have three grandkids, so we spend a lot of time with the family. My wife and I get to spend a lot of time together, travel with the family, which is, I'm very, very lucky and blessed. I know that. I also think we're only on this earth once. So enjoy, have a great trip, but also share with others when you can. And that's what I'm trying to do. When I looked, you know, something I've learned in business is focus. I mean, you can look at all the problems in the world, and if you try to solve all of them, you'll raise your hand and say, I can't do anything about it. And even if you concentrate on one, you probably cannot, but at least you can make a more meaningful
impact. Really.
So when I looked and I said, what's important to me, what helped me to get where I am, and I think education is huge. Number one, it brought me where I am today. But number two, when you look about social mobility, equality, and so forth, the more educated people, the more we educate people, it elevates social mobility and create equality, less, you know, population growth, being aware of the environment and things like that. So I decided to focus there. So I looked at where I can make the biggest impact, and Channel Island really fits the mode that I came from. Our 50, it's the youngest university in the Cal State system. 50% of the students are Hispanics. 60% are first generation in their family, basically meet my profile, you know, in immigrants, first generation, 80% qualify for financial aid. So the impact we can make, and Channel Island today is in 18th in the nation in social mobility. And it doesn't mean that our graduate makes more money than Harvard or Berkeley or so forth, but you measure where they start from. So the impact of their life is significantly, you know, it's significantly greater. And that's where I thought I want to put my energy. And also, I think the Channel Island, unfortunately, has a brand identity in Santa Barbara. People don't know. This is really our Cal State campus, and we don't know about it, you know?
Right. It really is. And it's true. It's kind of like one of those best kept secrets.
Exactly. When I was looking for a Cal State, when I lived in L.A., I mean, I had like four campuses to choose from, Cal State L.A., Cal State Northridge, Dominguez Hill, and so forth. Here, it's either Cal State Northridge, and it's not commutable, mm-hmm. or San Luis Obispo. So it's a great university. It's in our backyard. We also offer classes and degrees here in our campus in Santa Barbara. So my goal is to both to help the student over there and to introduce the university to the community here, both the students and the business community.
This is 52 minutes into the show, and I have not had a chance to make a political statement, so I am going to now, and that is I don't understand why Governor Brown is going to cut funding to the Cal State system. It doesn't make any sense. And if you just take a look at what he and the Democrats typically say, which is what you just said, education is so important, how can you cut back on education? And on that editorial note, we're going to take a break and come back with our final segment. You're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB.
Hi, I'm Diane Duva with an invitation for you to enjoy a great dining experience at my favorite restaurant, the world-famous Arnaldi's Cafe. One of Santa Barbara's oldest and most intimate restaurants since 1940. It's located on the corner of Olive and Cota Streets in downtown Santa Barbara. Arnaldi's specializes in traditional home-style Italian food prepared with the freshest produce, finest quality meats and fish, and the very best imported Italian meats, cheeses, and olive oil, along with local fish and specials from our Santa Barbara Farmers Market, and an extensive wine list served in the unique atmosphere of a candlelit dining room. Arnaldi's also caters to weddings and rehearsal dinners, receptions, graduations, birthdays, holiday parties, or any special event, with two large dining rooms, a huge heated patio, fire pit, two bocce ball courts, and a stone barbecue with red oak wood. And Arnaldi's is happy to work with you to create a custom menu and handle any special requests. Visit Arnaldi's.com or call 805-962-5394.
For prospective homebuyers, one of the most important steps of the loan process is getting clear and honest information from someone who will speak plainly and truthfully about loan programs and options.
I'm Kelly Marsh, Vice President, California, of Cornerstone Home Lending, where our highly skilled and experienced team takes great pride in helping clients obtain home financing with honest, knowledgeable, fast, friendly, and efficient service. As a Santa Barbara native who has spent the past 20 years in the mortgage industry and has closed over 4,000 loans, I'd appreciate the opportunity to earn your business and invite you to visit thekellymarshteam.com or call my office at 805-563-1100 to learn more about how Cornerstone Home Lending can help you determine the best way to manage mortgage debt to achieve a more stable financial future.
Licensed by the Department of Business Oversight under the California Residential Mortgage Lending Act. California Residential Mortgage Lending Act license number 41DB072220. California Financial Lending Law license number 60DB072528. Loan originator NMLS number 245822. Not a commitment to loan. Equal housing opportunity.
Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm founded on providing thoughtful, objective, and comprehensive financial guidance for families and entities who are seeking long-term financial confidence.
And so, Zohar, thank you so much for being here with us today. But as we enter into our last segment of the show, you know, as I think about your unplanned journey, what advice do you have for people listening that you would give people going through their career path, you know, whether it be starting out or mid-career, really?
A few things I've learned, you know, in my life, and in no particular order, is – if you think about, you know, someone who is in a job and so forth, and especially today, there is no more job security. But there is knowledge security. And what I mean by that, learn as much as you can, and especially about technology. Because every one of us, you might say, oh, I'm an artist, I don't need to know about technology. No, we all need to know about technology today. I mean, you cannot get a job without having computer skills or so forth. Part of knowledge security is networking. We got to network. 75% of jobs are found through networking. Most of my jobs I found through networking. The Deckers job was the networking jobs. You know, the story you heard about the Domino Pizza, that's a great opportunity for me. And that was all through networking.
Right. What's that saying? It's not what you know, it's who you know.
It's who you know.
You know what I did when I, right before I retired and I sold my business, I took a look at all my big clients and I tracked them all back to one recommendation 20 years earlier from someone I networked with. So I am 1,000% convinced that networking is the most important.
And we are not, by nature, most people are not good at that. You know, I love people. I mean, one of the things that I enjoy about is talking to people, meeting, and connecting people. And network not with the idea of what it's going to do for me. Because also people see through that. Mm-hmm. You know, because you care about people and do it, and it's not a shame at all. Don't burn your bridges. You know, you never know where you're going to end up because there's such mobility today. And also with social media, I mean, you can see everything. So be careful about that. One thing I learned from my mom, be positive. You know, nobody wants to work with someone who is a negative person, you know.
What is it from Saturday Night Live, the Debbie Downer?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, follow up. It's amazing to me how many people, especially like a service provider, someone don't follow up. I mean, do what you say you're going to do. I mean, you'll stand up. You know when you do stuff like that. Look for opportunities and take advantage of them. The opportunity will come your way. You know, be prepared for that and take advantage of them. And also give every opportunity a chance. You're not going to be successful at all of them. I didn't have time to talk to all the jobs that I did in the 8 years, one of them was a bankrupt. That was the worst part of my business career. But I've learned from that, and it helped me to get to where I am. Someone asked me, how do you define success? Success is not how big a house you have, how much money you have. It's doing what you love and be the best of that. You know, and part of that is finding the culture that you like and the people that you want to work with, because it's not fun to work in a place which you're not happy. By the way, that's an aspiration, because sometimes you don't have a choice. I understand
right.
that, you know.
No, but it's so true. Like the culture of the place that you work, or the culture that you want to define or create if you are an owner of the company, is
exactly.
really important.
The culture is everything. It's all about the people. If I've learned about something in my 40 years career, it's all about the people. Find a good mentor. People like to help. You know, find someone that can help you, that can be your guide. Also, your integrity is everything you have. Don't let it go. That's the only thing we have, your integrity, reputation. And finally, be prepared. You know, remember, we cannot plan our life, but be prepared to take advantage when opportunity comes your way.
Well, thank you so much for not only all those great words of wisdom, but for being such an important part of the community and remain such an important part of the community and all you're doing for CSU Channel Islands. Zohar Zev, thank you for being here. You're listening to Money. You've listened to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be back next week.
It's